Thursday, 31st of January 2019, meeting of Parliament, suspension of standing order, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to move under standing order 7.3, suspend standing order 7.1, in order to proceed with a government statement.
Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
Mr. Speaker, yesterday, you called the committee stage in third reading of the bill on the EU withdrawal. In doing so, you asked whether all honourable members agreed, which is the formulation required by the rules. The rules require unanimity for a bill to go through all its stages on one day. But there's no longer the practice of the House to take a bill through all its stages in one day. In fact, in the 15 years that I've been a member of this House, I have never seen any member exercise his or her right to delay a bill passing its stages by a day. In fact, the delay could even have been less than a whole day. It was open to the government to have returned at 1 minute after midnight this morning. In fact, to use the device of the right to delay for a day is a futile exercise unless one needs to consider or check a point. Potentially, if the debate in the second reading had changed in understanding or interpretation, it might be necessary to delay the passage of the bill to make those additional consultations. Yesterday, however, Mr. Speaker, the leader, the honourable leader of the opposition, simply decided to exercise his right to delay for a day without giving any explanation to the House. He did so, Mr. Speaker, not just in relation to any bill. He did so in respect of a bill which I have certified as urgent under the Constitution. You reminded the House of that certification at the start of the debate on the second reading yesterday. The Deputy Chief Minister, in his excellent presentation of the bill at the second reading, explained the need to have the bill on the Senate book expeditiously for a number of reasons which were detailed in his speech. He also explained that he had provided the command paper of the bill as an opportunity for honourable members and the rest of the community to comment and consider the issues that gave rise to even before it became a bill. The bill has been published for almost 6 weeks. In fact, the bill would have been published for 6 weeks by Friday. Yesterday, however, when the leader of the opposition decided to exercise his right to delay the bill, he did not tell us why he had decided to be the first person in living memory to delay a bill in that way. He also, I'm going to make progress at this stage, Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Member writes, it's a statement, and members are not interrupted when they're making a statement.
Now, I will give the Honourable Member an opportunity when the Chief Minister finishes his statement. I have no problem in calling him.
Mr. Speaker, I also did not bother to ask, during the recess or otherwise in debate, why you have continued with the bill of emergency plan and why you have not waited until Friday to proceed with it. Without notice, he decided to use the unprecedented device of not agreeing to the committee stage and the third reading being taken in the same day. It's important, Mr. Speaker, that the House and the whole community should understand the consequences of the decision by the Leader of the Opposition to delay the passage of the bill yesterday. First of all, as all honourable members know, the Gazette issues every Thursday morning. This morning, the Gazette is not issued as usual. It is now held back pending passage of the bill. That means that many tens or hundreds of legal notices, etc., are delayed, thanks to the decision of the honourable member to delay the passage of the bill by one day. These notices are of the businesses of individuals and other businesses and companies throughout the land who are required by law to publish notices in the Gazette. Secondly, I see that the honourable leader of the opposition is laughing from a sedentary position, Mr. Speaker, as if this were fun. Well, let me just tell him that I'm building up to the most serious consequences, and he might not feel like laughing at the end of it. Secondly, the acting governors on standby to sign the passage of the bill into law as soon as we end the third reading and the clerk confirms that the law has been passed by the Parliament. Why the urgency, Mr. Speaker? Because thirdly and most importantly, Mr. Speaker, a failure to pass the bill yesterday means that there is now a risk that the United Kingdom will not be able to extend to Gibraltar the provision on two of the Hague Convention. The first recovery of child support and other forms of family maintenance of 2007. These are multilateral international agreements to which the EU is a party. Both agreements have been implemented in Gibraltar through regulations made under Section 23G2 of the Interpretation and General Clauses Act, which confers a power to make regulations in matters arising under the treaty as defined by Section 2 of the European Community Act. The UK has committed to continuing its participation in both conventions after it leaves the EU. It deposited instruments of accession with the depositors, which is the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs, on the 28th of March 2018. In accordance with the procedures laid down in the convention, the UK's accession will enter into force on the 1st of April 2019. That is to say, the first day of the month following the expiration of 3 months after the deposit of the UK's instrument of accession. That is in keeping with Section 31(2)(a) of the 2005 Convention and Section 62(a) of the 2007 Convention. And I repeat that for the record, it's Section 60, Section 2(a). The UK will only become a party in its own right on the 1st of April 2019 if there is a major Brexit. If there is a withdrawal agreement with a transition period agreed before the 29th of March 2019, the UK will withdraw its instrument of accession and the conventions will continue to apply to the UK and Gibraltar during the transition period. After today, Mr. Speaker, I imagine the legal disposition will be functional for a withdrawal agreement and a transition period. The UK has not yet made declarations extending the application of the conventions to Gibraltar. It was agreed with us. But it is not possible to do so until the withdrawal bill before the House today becomes an act. Because until then, there is no legislative basis for Gibraltar to be covered by the Convention in its own right and not via EU law. Declarations by the United Kingdom post accession extending the application of the Convention to Gibraltar will also take effect on the first day of the month following the expiration of 3 months after the date on which the notification is received by the depository. Section 32, subsection 4 of the 2005 Convention and Section 63, subsection 4 of the 2007 Convention makes that provision. Thus, if the United Kingdom government decides to make the declaration today, the 31st of January 2019, and these are received and deemed to have been validly made by the depository today, the convention would enter into force in relation to Gibraltar on the 1st of May 2019. That is the first possible day on which they will enter into effect. For the UK to be able to make the declaration today, therefore, the bill has to pass expeditiously as soon as possible. If the UK declarations are made after the 31st of January 2019, that is to say, today, which is what would happen if we delay too much further today, my provisional view is that the earliest the convention could enter into force in Gibraltar would be 30 days later, in keeping with the formulation, which would mean, Mr. Speaker, on the 1st of June 2019. Such a delay, Mr. Speaker, would potentially be hugely damaging for individuals and businesses seeking to rely on the provisions of the Hague Convention as well as for Gibraltar as a jurisdiction more generally. We would be, Mr. Speaker, the only jurisdiction on the European continent not to have that cover for those additional 30 days. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, it remains unclear whether the United Kingdom is able to make a declaration extending the Convention to Gibraltar before the UK's own accession enters into force on the 1st of April. But the government's advice is not aware of any state practice under either of the two relevant conventions on this point. Australian advisers have raised doubts about the position, but have not yet taken a view on it. Secondly, it may be possible for the UK to rely on the fact that declarations made at the time of signature, that is to say, ratification or accession, take effect simultaneously with the entry into force of the convention for the state concerned. If the depository could be persuaded that declarations made by the UK on the 1st of April 2019, the day of the UK's accession entering into force, and that these were made at the time of accession, despite the instrument of accession having been deposited on the 28th of December, it may be possible for the UK to extend the Convention of Gibraltar with effect from the 1st of April 2019. Again, there is no state practice under the Hague Convention that I'm aware of on the time of acceptance. SBO lawyers told our advisors at the last meeting that they were investigating this case. Ultimately, the UK may consider it acceptable to make the declarations on the 1st of April 2019 in the event of a no deal Brexit, rather than to now have to rush to make them today, assuming we can get the notification to London on time this afternoon, and when the risks have been rebuffed by the depositors. And that, Mr. Speaker, is the consequence of Mr. Phillips' decision yesterday to decide to exercise the power to delay the passage of the bill through all its stages in London. In effect, Mr. Speaker, potentially delaying, or worse, prejudicing the ability of families enforcing judgment on child support and maintenance. Potentially delaying or worse, prejudicing the ability of litigants to choose jurisdictions of courts for dispute. In effect, Mr. Speaker, potentially delaying or worse, prejudicing the extension to Gibraltar of two important conventions which are a part of our law today, but which we have to make separate provision for in the post-Brexit environment. The House should proceed to committee now, Mr. Speaker, with the full knowledge of this potential delay or worse, prejudice now being a real and present danger for Gibraltar families and for the jurisdiction. Thanks to Mr. Phillips.
The Honourable Leader of the Opposition. Mr. Speaker, that statement by the Chief Minister is with the greatest respect utter nonsense, Mr. Speaker. It is a smoke screen for his incompetence and negligence in that dealing with the other day, Mr. Speaker.
On a point of order, in response to a ministerial statement, you can ask questions on points of clarification. And I even tend to allow, and I have done so very many occasions in the case of the Honourable Danny Peter when he was in the meeting, I even allow a response. But what I cannot allow is that kind of language, because it is not called for. That kind of language that the Honourable Jordan has just used is not called for in the circumstances of what happened yesterday or what has happened today. And I am not going to preside today on an important moment in the life of this Parliament, which perhaps the most important piece of legislation that has come here in over 40 years, and I am not a speaker going to preside on the behavior of members as if they were school children. I expect you, as the elected members of Parliament that you are representing the people, to exercise discretion and to act as grown-up and not as children, because if you act as children, I will treat you as children. I'm sorry I have to be so clear, but it is the first time in a long time that I have had to take this attitude, because it is not called for. Now you may continue.
Great, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister could have brought this bill last week. He could have brought it the week before. He could have brought it on Monday of this week, Mr. Speaker. Instead, he leaves it to the very last minute. He doesn't explain in any detail whatsoever in his contribution and intervention. Indeed, the Deputy Minister has explained in their intervention the urgency of this bill, Mr. Speaker. And when we, as a democratically elected opposition of this House, deal with a bill of this importance, we take a view, we consider the detail, we consider the responses of honourable members of this, and we look to delay the passage of this bill by 24 hours. We know we will do our job for the people of this community, we will do our job in analysing the legislation that's put forward by the government, and it's the Chief Minister's fault, Mr. Speaker. If he brings it at the possible length of this minute without explaining in any way whatsoever the urgency of the bill, that is on his hands, Mr. Speaker, no one else's. Mr. Speaker, we are here to do a job.
That in his hands is a non parliamentary statement. Please withdraw it. Making the words, because we are in Parliament, and there is language that is allowed and language that is not allowed. I rule that that is on his hands is a non parliamentary statement, and I ask you to withdraw those words.
For the sake of giving that message across, of course, I will withdraw those words specifically. Continuing with the statement, I will report it.
I comply with the direction that you have given me, Mr. Speaker.
to do all of the scrutiny that he said that he wanted to do overnight. So either they've done none of their work in the past 9 weeks, or they were left with arguments yesterday which they had not understood before. And I think it's a secret. If I was being generous to them, I would say, I would venture to suggest that actually, they've dawned on them yesterday that all of the things that Robert Demers today said were completely wrong. And he took it in, but he has to. This bill is not a bill to bring the withdrawal agreement into effect. There will be a separate bill for that. The Honourable Deputy Minister has already said so. This bill includes a clause that will enable us to bring the withdrawal agreement into effect. If there is no time to bring a bill, then bring a bill without a shall anyway. And he knows that because he was told that at the meeting of the Fair Committee. But most importantly, Mr. Speaker, in the talk that the Honourable Gentleman has put before the tribunal today, the Parliament today, he has said that we are trying to stop scrutiny of the MOU and of the protocol. Well, Mr. Speaker, where's the motion from them putting the MOU before the House in order to debate them? Where's the motion from them saying that they don't like the MOU? The government cannot stop a motion from the opposition like in the United Kingdom. In the United Kingdom, the government has control of the order paper. And an opposition motion is given the time that is agreed at this meeting in the House, and they can be shunted to one side. Hence, all of the need for a meaningful vote. Here, if they want to have the debate about the MOUs, which I would be delighted to have with the text of the MOUs in the House, they can put an estimate in time. It is utter nonsense to say that we're stopping them out from that debate. It's not worthy, Mr. Speaker, of the community having to hear it. Because it's not true. If they want to debate the MOU, put a motion on the MOU, and wait until we have to have the debate on the withdrawal agreement bill, if there is a withdrawal agreement, because then there will be a bill. It's that simple. But there's absolutely no sense whatsoever, parliamentary sense, legal sense, or common sense, in what the Honourable Gentleman has said. Absolutely no sense whatsoever. That is, he's saying that we can no longer give them the benefit of as long as possible to consider a bill before certifying it as urgent. Well, we found it to see that. We can certify bills as urgent overnight and not give them 6 weeks to consider, or close to 6 weeks to consider those bills as necessary. Because that is the natural consequence of what he has invited us to do today. But then, for him to get up today, as a leader of the opposition in this community, I do rightly say, and probably one of the most important pieces of legislation that this community will have the misfortune of having to consider for many generations. And I have pointed out to him what the natural consequences of his decision to throw his vote out of the ground with a knee-jerk reaction to something that probably they made on the House yesterday, and say, it's not my fault, it's such a political fault. He let himself down so badly, Mr. Speaker, and he let the community down so badly that he demonstrates, Mr. Speaker, that he really is not up to the job. I'm grateful that he ruled some of the things that he said out of unparliamentary language, because they were really not called for, Mr. Speaker. And frankly, I think it will reflect very badly on him as a professional, as a politician, and as an individual, that he has said to you, Mr. Speaker, that he is only withdrawing what he said out of respect for the office, as if he were trying to distinguish the office and you, Mr. Speaker. Because you are disturbing of maximum respect, not just because of the chair in which you sit, but because of the contribution you have made to public life in Jibril. Mr. Speaker, it is not true for the Honourable Gentleman to say that I have accused him of threatening families. Mr. Speaker, my words, which are in a written statement that you will have the opportunity of falling over for many years to come, when he realized that this was the moment when his political career brushed against the brick wall that he built for it himself, let's say that his actions potentially delay or were prejudice the ability of families and forcing judgment on child support and maintenance. If he interprets that as threatening families, it's in his mind that the threat was made and became real, not in the words that I put before the Parliament, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, how can you say that although they support the bill as a hall, they're only concerned about parts of it. So that were the case, which is a little of what they said, but not any of what they did, what they would have done would have been support the bill at second reading, having entered the caveats that they entered, and then they would have asked, in the committee stage, to have Section 12 put on its own, they would have voted against Section 12, having supported the rest of the section, and then they would have supported the bill at third reading, Mr. Speaker. That would have been, I would give way to the Honourable Gentleman before I sit down, or when I finish this point. That would have been the way to deal with an issue relating to their concern about one section. They would have instead voted down. I saw the other lady yesterday, that's not what they were going to achieve. They have attempted to vote down the whole of the bill, not just the section. The other gentleman has asked me to give way. I will, although
he has asked for 2 minutes, he should give way to him. Let me ask that, Mr. Speaker, I'm going to finish up the line. Thank you. Thank you very much. And Mr. Speaker, actually, the decision that was taken yesterday to not to object to the commission that was taken yesterday was precisely to see whether we could support the bill, but just simply focus on some of the provisions within the bill. That was the purpose of it. And indeed, candidly, at the Parliament, there are some of us that believe, well, actually, this bill is very complicated, and you can't just simply hone in on one or two provisions without especially not having enough respect for another provision. So, in fact, the decision was taken in good faith in order to see whether we could support the government in this project to the maximum extent possible. That was the reason why it was taken. And of course, if the opposition had known about all the urgency and all the other matters that the Honourable Deputy Minister has outlined in his contribution, we may have taken a different view. But I want the Parliament to understand, and indeed I want the community to understand that is listening to this debate, that it was a decision, that was taken in good faith by my own understanding of the opposition.
I must start by welcoming the Honourable Gentleman back from the sort of parliamentary vacation in parliamentary history. He performed a Mrs. Slocum style stunt when he got up and said that he was vacating the Parliament, which of course means that all of us would have to leave the Parliament in his direction. In fact, all he was doing was himself leaving the Parliament. But I was reminded of that great character who used to stand up and say, "I am unanimous in this," which is what the Honourable Gentleman, which is the stunt that the Honourable Gentleman, the Honourable Gentleman has performed today. But Mr. Speaker, you know, he got up when I was dealing with a particular part of my statement. So that was, I think, was a general intervention. He could very easily have done that at another time. I will deal with what he has said and then move on to continue with what I was replying to the Honourable Ladies of the Opposition. Mr. Speaker, if it is true that they made the decision in the way that he suggests that he made it, and I will not say that what he has said is not true, but I will tell him that it stretches the bound of credulity on this part of the House, they would have said to us, "You have said that this is urgent, you have certified it as urgent, we are thinking that we need 24 more hours, does that cause any problems?" When he was in the opposition, he and I have probably the most precious relationship that this Parliament has seen. But nonetheless, when this was related to certifying bills as urgent, we were able to talk. And this is a bill certified as urgent, which they have made still in the order paper for a day longer. I am very surprised that somebody was in that vein, having heard also from the mover of the bill that the bill was urgent, that they make what they say is a conspiracy gesture to try and support the whole bill without having that conversation. So he will keep me to say that I think he has a view of his political antennae rightly tuned in to what has happened. He has realized more quickly than perhaps the others how badly they have played it. He has tried to give the Honourable Gentleman to the next one a little bit of cover in so far as he has cover to give, Mr. Speaker. And it is really stretching the bounds. grounds of credibility, and certainly there might be people outside of this house who might take the view that you have to get up and invent a way around this difficulty. Because, Mr. Speaker, don't the Honourable Gentleman say that there are parts of this bill which are not democratic, which they don't like, which give us the ability to pass them through and hinder your powers, Mr. Speaker, which is what the bill does in the special some legislation. And if that's what they said yesterday, in the course of that statement, they agree with. Those are the things they said that approved in the bill. In the House of Commons, the debate has been about having Henry VIII powers to change laws because it's necessary in extremis to go in that way. That's the bit they said they didn't object to. Except for the mentions of the Cochrane Amendment about the MOUs and the withdrawal agreement. Well, let's pick it up one defined section. One defined section. For the Speaker, it is frankly not believable that they should expect the community to think that we are looking for what they termed a blank check. There is no blank check here, Mr. Speaker. There is, if necessary, the ability to implement the withdrawal agreement, if there is a withdrawal agreement, but already a commitment to bring a withdrawal agreement bill anyway, Mr. Speaker, if it is necessary. Mr. Speaker, you know, frankly, I think that if I say that the Honourable Gentleman is expecting credulity, and I'm now talking about the leader of the opposition, people might say, well, this is going to say, doing battle with his opposite number, or I don't know if it's true, frankly, and it's normal he should say that. But Mr. Speaker, you see, when I've given the explanations that I've given, and I've said the things that I've said, and I get the reaction that I get, it's obvious that they just did not think this through, Mr. Speaker. It demonstrates in the particular irresponsibility, Mr. Speaker, of the statement that we're seeing played out today, even after I said that the bill is urgent. Mr. Speaker, and you know what? I say these things actually with a heavy heart. I say them with a very heavy heart because this is a very serious moment in the affairs of our nation. And to have to be having this debate, then what we should be doing is getting down to deal with the bill, to get it across the line, is frankly worse than remarkable.
Honourable Ray Clinton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. First of all, I would invite the Chief Minister to withdraw a remark he made earlier, as I'm sure he would not wish to mislead the House.
And he said in all his 16 years in Parliament, he had never seen a mechanism whereby a delay to the committee stage had occurred. I certainly, since I've been here, have been used once. I know this because it was in fact myself and my honourable colleague, Mr. Peterson, who, as my memory serves me right, on the Consultative Council Bill actually exercised that right. So I invite the Chief Minister to withdraw that remark, or at least amend it. But certainly it has been used before, and certainly in the right of the Parliament, Mr. Speaker, as I'm sure you will recall. Mr. Speaker, that right is in standing order. He never certified the bill as urgent. He gave no reason to us as to why he's urgent. He comes to us today saying, you didn't know that was urgent, you had to do it, but Mr. Speaker, we were not aware. At least come today, and we've only wasted close to 3/4 of an hour for his statement. If it is that urgent, Mr. Speaker, I invite him to let the committee stage and get on with it. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. But Mr. Speaker, if I say I can't remember something in living memory, it's because I can't remember it. And therefore, I'm not going to withdraw it on the face of the Honourable Gentleman opposite. If it did happen, well, he could sit behind him and send me a copy of his rights, and then he could invite me to correct the record of his rights. But I'm certainly not going to be getting down to check the hands of him. I don't have time, Mr. Speaker, like he does, given that he's a retiree, to have coffee in the mornings and enjoy reading my hands cards regularly just because it's my hobby. Well, Speaker, that is the first point. Secondly, Mr. Speaker, of course they're entitled to delay the committee stage by day. It's in the rules. I haven't suggested it's not his right to do so. Of course it's entitled to do so. I am alluding to what the consequences of what they have done is. And what they haven't got an answer to, what they haven't apologized for, and what they're continuing to have spark on about is the consequences of what they've done. Because it really seems to be that honourable members of it have such a casual relationship with the reality of what politics is and the consequences it has on people's lives.
told that they enjoy politics and they might, you know, make good in Parliament, and that's why they're here and that's what they're doing. Politics is consequences for people's lives. Political actions are consequences for people's lives, and the sooner they realise it, the better, Mr. Speaker. The sooner they realise it, the sooner they will realise what it is that they should be doing to earn their £40,000 a year.
Mr. Speaker, this is very much a point of clarification. In his statement, the Chief Minister went to some length to describe the consequences of his later debate. The officers have said not aware, and neither of those consequences have made clear at any point. I don't think they were necessarily explained the decision because this is a very important piece of legislation. What I don't understand is that if the consequences or the risk of those consequences are so grave in the Chief Minister's mind, why didn't he recall it at 1 minute past midnight last night to get this bill through? Because it was in his gift to do so. It would have meant that the bill would have been passed last night or in the early hours of the morning and ready to be sent to London first thing this morning. Instead, we have this significant delay, a delay exacerbated by the Chief Minister's own statement this afternoon, which of course a further 45-minute delay for the passage of the bill. I just don't understand that point. Why will we not recall? I, and I'm sure all of my colleagues, with the factory returned at 1 minute past midnight, with the second intervening period, discussing and having that very important discussion that we had this morning about why certain measures and how we were going to approach the bill in the committee stage. That was very necessary for us to do. It's really our democratic right, but it's a very important thing that we do that to hold. To apply the proper scrutiny to the legislation. We are serving the people of Gibraltar in that respect. Why was the bill not brought at 1 minute past midnight last night to the committee stage?
And Mr. Speaker, did the Labour government think that it made sense to come back at 1 minute after midnight? Because it is possible to come back 1 minute after midnight. But if we come back 1 minute after midnight, I have to keep all of the public offices of Gibraltar who keep this Parliament open here, unnecessarily, because of their foibles. Because of their foibles. Because of the cocktail of egotism and bigotism and protagonism that they come up with in order to try and justify their position. We didn't know it was urgent. We didn't know the reasons why it was urgent. We didn't ask why it was urgent. Has that ever occurred to them? We didn't ask why it was urgent. It is frankly, in my view, a cocktail of Abyssinian stupor that they drink themselves into with their politics. So, Mr. Speaker, this community needs a EU withdrawal that none of us want. And we use it sooner rather than later. And the judgment of the community on the way that this opposition has behaved and the fall of the GST from what it was to what it is today is still to come.
The Honourable Chief Minister, we will now move the suspension of standing orders to go back into.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move standing order 7-3 to suspend standing order 7-1 in order to figure government bill.
Those in favour, as again, carried. Committee stage is for reading the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House should resolve itself into committee to consider the following bills clause by clause. The European Union withdrawal bill 2018 and the Parliament Amendments Act 2019.
A great project to amend the provisions of the Parliament Act to provide for an open register of electors. Clauses 1 to 3. Under this note of the short title is now the European Union Withdrawal Act 2019. We're doing this. Clauses 1 to 3. Stand part of the bill.
Will you thank him? Stand proud of him. I don't come up to provide for the repeal of the Return to Nature Act, to repeal Section 23, Journal of the Interpretation and General Clauses Act, to provide for the continuing validity of legislation passed to make for the purposes of complying with any obligation arising out of devoted membership of the European Union, to repeal the European Parliamentary Elections Act, to provide for the continuation and validity of any administrative act or decision made pursuant to such an obligation, and to provide by way of particular legislation powers to amend, repeal, or replace any enactment which is made, whether primarily or otherwise for or in connection with any such European Union obligations, to make such consequential amendments relating to the membership of the European Economic Area, to provide such transitional or other provisions as are deemed necessary and for connected purposes. Clause 1.
There is no need for a formal amendment. 2018 to be substituted by 2019.
Clause 2.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 3.
Can the Deputy Minister explain that interaction with Clause 12? We'd like some simple clarification as to whether or not to ratify those words in brackets.
Mr. Chairman, I explained yesterday to the House that the bill, which is basically the original UK bill, was drafted before the withdrawal agreement was concluded. So the provision was made, this defines a withdrawal agreement, not necessarily the withdrawal agreement, and there will be a second bill, or the government intends to bring a second bill, to be having the time to do that, which will be one of the European Union withdrawal agreement bills, which will be specifically on the agreement. So this provides, as I explained, and as I think you remember, understood yesterday, the bill provides for the government to adopt the withdrawal agreement by regulation if there is no parliamentary chance. But that is not our intention. Our intention is to bring a separate bill and have a separate discussion on the withdrawal agreement.
Mr. Chairman, so therefore, by reason of that definition, the power does exist for a minister or the chief minister to pass regulations implementing the withdrawal agreement.
Mr. Speaker, we don't need to repeat ourselves, do we?
Mr. Chairman, just for the sake of clarity, if the Deputy Chief Minister could confirm if we understand without any shadow of doubt what he's saying, is that it is his preference to bring a specific withdrawal bill itself, but if he cannot, he would rely on the provisions on the Section 12 to pass whatever he thinks is necessary by way of regulation, and therefore bypassing the ability of this Parliament to scrutinise whatever it is that he thinks is necessary. If I understand him correct.
In order to make sure that we all have the same understanding, I will repeat what I said yesterday about those words for the benefit of the London members. And I said this. Clause 12 gives the Minister the power to make subsidiary legislation to implement a withdrawal agreement concluded between the UK and the EU. And to satisfy this provision, it is present in UK legislation. It serves purely and simply as a safety mechanism. In case there is no chance we can produce a separate withdrawal agreement act, which remains the intention and the direction of the government. Clearly, the provision would not apply in the event of a so-called no-deal Brexit.
Clause 3, stand part of the bill.
Clause 4.
understand quite a little bit. There is
faith.
Stand quite a little bit. There is
six.
Stand quite a little bit.
Page 7.
Stand quite a little bit.
Page 8.
Stand quite a little bit.
Page 9.
Stand quite a little bit.
Page 10.
Stand quite a little bit.
Page 11.
No, stand part of the bill.
Page 12.
Mr. Chairman, on the government concern, why it did not include the similar words that appear in Section 9 of the European Union Withdrawal Act of the United Kingdom, subject to the prior enactment of the statute by Parliament approving the final terms of the withdrawal agreement of the United Kingdom, we obviously Gibraltar. Can the government confirm why there was no protection, as we see it, for Parliament to be reconvened on a separate bill within that?
Well, Parliament can be reconvened at short notice under the existing standing orders and rules. There's no need to have a provision to reconvene Parliament. In this Parliament, it's possible for the opposition to step down for debate on the motion matters which relate to the MOUs or the withdrawal agreement, some of which they haven't chosen to do. We've already indicated that we wish to have a withdrawal agreement bill, or that we see a withdrawal agreement bill. And finally, I'm reminded of the only man who has been able to lead the deals into victory in general elections in Gibraltar, who used to sit in the chair I now occupy, and who used to say, "I think if things are done in a particular way in the United Kingdom, it doesn't mean they're the best place to do them for Gibraltar."
Mr. Chairman, the point that I'm trying to make a quick clarification on is why our Section 12 allows a minister, by way of regulation, to introduce subsidiary legislation, to introduce and implement the Whitfield Agreement, whilst in the United Kingdom they have the same provision, but which allows Parliament to approve the final terms. We do not appear to have that part of it. In our law, and can they clarify what the decision to leave that out, given the fact that 95% of this bill replicates the UK Act?
I really do despair. The Honourable Gentleman appears not to understand the structure of what we are debating, let alone the politics of it. Once the United Kingdom adopts a withdrawal agreement, let's assume for a moment that the United Kingdom adopts a withdrawal agreement. That withdrawal agreement, Mr. Speaker, will bite. That agreement will bite. It will bite in respect of Gibraltar. Even if there are no MOUs on Gibraltar, even if there is no protocol on Gibraltar, let's just for a moment assume that there are none in a withdrawal agreement. It will bite. Therefore, Mr. Speaker, whether or not this Parliament approves the withdrawal agreement, all 585 pages of it, the withdrawal agreement will be effective in withdrawing Gibraltar from the European Union. I think the Honourable Members have understood that. If there is a withdrawal agreement, and if it includes parts about Gibraltar, as it does at the moment, if it is ratified, we have already indicated that we will bring a withdrawal agreement. And I think this is the 10th time we said that just this afternoon, Mr. Speaker. It's in the printed text of what the Honourable Royal Secretary of the Deputy said yesterday. In fact, I think it's prominently displayed in all the reports I've seen of what the Deputy Chief Minister said yesterday. Given they had an extra 24 hours to consider what was said yesterday, because I would have thought that would have been crystal clear by now. In the event that there is a withdrawal agreement, and there is what one might call the last minute, the 28th of March, for example, Mr. Speaker, that withdrawal agreement will bite until on the morning of the 29th of March, or on the morning of the 30th of March. It may not be possible, Mr. Speaker, to have a withdrawal agreement bill ready by then for the Parliament to debate. If we are saying we will have a withdrawal agreement bill after that, but we may need to implement parts of the withdrawal agreement which they might not like, and which we might not like, Mr. Speaker. Or this which we like and they don't like, or this which they might like more than we like, but we are forced to do because we are in government, Mr. Speaker.
And that is why, for the 18th time, there is a provision to enable ministers to give effect to a withdrawal agreement, even though they're going to bring their bill for them to the vote, Mr. Speaker, on the issue of the withdrawal agreement. But if they feel so strongly about the MOUs and the protocol, why haven't they brought a motion? Because I very much look forward to a motion where we can debate the MOUs and the protocol, because I'd be able to demonstrate to them, not that demonstrating things through a method, Mr. Speaker, why they're completely wrong in their interpretations that they've shared today. Now, Mr. Speaker, if they want me to repeat that again, or they want another member on the center to repeat that again for a further time, because I haven't yet understood it, it will only be when they read Hansard that they realize how many times they have to be told. Mr. Clinton, in the morning for a coffee, might enjoy this particular extract.
I understand the point that the Honourable, the Chief Minister makes, which is essentially that he says, if the withdrawal agreement is approved by the UK Parliament, it becomes effective, it's been passed by the UK Parliament, it includes provisions in relation to Gibraltar, and the reality, as he's saying, is the reality is that it bites when we bring a withdrawal agreement for this Parliament, a withdrawal agreement act for this Parliament tomorrow. That's how I have understood it. So really, the purpose of bringing a separate withdrawal agreement to this Parliament really is to allow the Parliament to debate it. So from a legal standpoint, it's not strictly necessary. Now, if that is the position, forgive me if I perhaps express expositiveness in an elegant way, in order for there to be consensus and for us on this side of the House to be able to support the bill, is the government willing to consider some amendment to this particular section that includes the language that is used in the UK, which says, subject to prior enactment of a statute by Parliament approving the final terms of the withdrawal agreement. Now, I understand that, strictly speaking, once it's approved in the UK, it's done, it's dusted. This is an agreement between the United Kingdom and the EU. It's not an agreement between Gibraltar. I understand that. But at least it would allow the House to approach this from a unanimous point of view. And I wonder whether the government is willing to consider that. Mr. Speaker, the government cannot consider that. Now, again, this goes to the structure of the whole thing, the structure of the debate. Now, the vote is a part of the European Community under Article 3553 of the Treaty. When the United Kingdom withdraws its membership, we are no longer able to be part of the European Community under Article 3553. People north of the frontier and south of the Pyrenees are taking great relish in doing that analysis, which I know the Honourable Gentleman doesn't need me to do for him. Now, the United Kingdom, in order to enter into the withdrawal agreement, has given the House of Commons a meaningful vote. So that its withdrawal agreement, of which we are a part, but its withdrawal agreement, as the Honourable Gentleman has pointed out, because it's between the United Kingdom and the European Union, is a treaty that the United Kingdom is going to enter into. Before the United Kingdom enters into the treaty, it has given the Commons the ability to determine whether it should enter the treaty. Right? Once the Commons give that go-ahead, the treaty goes. Once the treaty goes, how can we have a clause in our law saying that we will not implement the provisions of the treaty which relate to Gibraltar unless the Parliament has approved it? Now, there is a way of describing that. There is a way of describing that, Mr. Speaker. Usually, you reflect the full lessons of international politics. The first one is good, the second one is good, the third one is bad. Because that is what we would be saying, Mr. Speaker. We would be saying that we would have an independent right to adopt the withdrawal agreement or not adopt the withdrawal agreement. I will share with the Honourable Gentleman some thinking which I shared with him in his legal opposition in this House. There may be parts of the withdrawal agreement that we are not prepared to accept for Gibraltar. Then, when we implement the withdrawal agreement,
we may take the view that we will not implement those parts of the withdrawal agreement. They will continue to fight against the United Kingdom in public international law vis-a-vis the other party, the counterparty, which is the European Union, Mr. Speaker. We would put the United Kingdom in default of its international legal obligations in respect of Gibraltar. Individuals would have claims against the signatory, which would be the United Kingdom, and the United Kingdom might have something to say yes. But the language that he is referring to is about prior approval for the entry of the treaty. In other words, the Commons, as we have been following on television, has to now give the Prime Minister the power to enter into the agreement. This is about what happens after there is an agreement internationally and how we give effect to it in this Parliament. That's why we cannot have that formulation of words. That's why this formula is to enable us to give effect in regulations or via regulations to the withdrawal agreement in extremis, but why we are committed to giving back the bill of the withdrawal agreement to the House if there is a withdrawal agreement to have the debate in the House. So they're going to have the debate if they want it. But I, Mr. Speaker, will not be persuaded that they want to have a debate. Because they could have had the debate. They could have put the MOU in a motion for debate in the House. If they wanted that debate, they could have had it in December. But it was interesting, Mr. Speaker. But there was one view in respect of the MOU in the Brexit Select Committee, and another one which has emerged thereafter, Mr. Speaker. And we're not having the debate on the MOU because nobody elected by the GOC to this House has put them to have the debate. But they could have had it. They could have put up the motion for debate. So we will bring a withdrawal agreement bill, and we will do that even if it's after the 29th of March. But in extremis and in the interim period, we need to have the power to give effect to the treaty that prior consent to the Commons, the government of the United Kingdom may have entered into. I hope I've broken it down sufficiently there.
Mr. Chairman, I understand all that. I was addressing the point in order to see whether there could be some unanimity, addressing the point that, of course, by parity of reasoning, of everything that the Honourable Gentleman and the Chief Minister has said, they don't need to bring a withdrawal agreement to this House. They don't need to. They're bringing a withdrawal agreement to this House in order to allow this House to have a debate on whatever issues relating to the withdrawal agreement this House wants to have a debate upon. That is how I have understood it. They don't need to bring a withdrawal agreement. Now, if they don't need to bring a withdrawal agreement, well, that's the way that I've understood it. If you don't need to, then of course you can introduce it. But the government is not going to be moved anyway. But that's the point that I would make. But then, I don't agree. It's not that we need or don't need to bring a withdrawal agreement. It's very clear, in our view, that we need to bring a bill to produce a withdrawal agreement act. Because there are some things that will require primary legislation. What we are doing with Clause 12 is giving ourselves an emergency power, in effect. In order to be able to do things in respect of the withdrawal agreement, where we may not have time, not even with an abridgment of time, to bring a withdrawal agreement, a withdrawal agreement bill to the House, but where we may need to start doing things. Things related to social security, things that will need to be done within a week. I'm very conscious, Mr. Speaker, that March, April is the period of Easter as well. We could find ourselves having to implement things during break time, so to speak. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, we believe that we do need to bring a withdrawal agreement back. If there is a withdrawal agreement, in order to do all the things that we will need to do through primary legislation, which will not be all of them, will be some of them. And in order to be able to do things quickly that we may have to do if there is a withdrawal agreement, before we're able to do that, we have this regulation making power. We are specific in that because the power in 12.1 is if the minister considers that that provision should be enforced on or before exit day. In the granted power, Mr. Speaker, to bring about the effect of the withdrawal agreement,
in keeping with at any time and going forward. This is a limited power. But I think the Liberal government wants to have the argument, they want to pretend that they have an issue, and they want to vote against the vote. And if this is the way that they're going to satisfy themselves to do so, so do it. But please, don't make us repeat ourselves anymore.
What effectively the government is saying is that when it refers to a withdrawal agreement, you're not referring to effectively the withdrawal agreement as the man in the street would understand the withdrawal agreement, which is the UK withdrawal agreement protocols that we would then understand it with the MEU. It's the effect of the withdrawal agreement. In other words, anything the government would need to do as a consequence of the UK Parliament having agreed to a withdrawal agreement and the UK having agreed with the EU the withdrawal agreement. That's essentially what we're saying. That's exactly what we're saying. And that's why there is a definition of withdrawal agreement, and that definition does not mean the withdrawal agreement that Theresa May is fighting over in the Commons. It's a definition of what a withdrawal agreement may be, which is not yet that, Mr. Speaker. Maybe that, but it's not yet that. But if the Liberal government looks at the clause, Mr. Speaker, not only is the power limited to amendments that we should consider to be necessary because provision should be enforced on or before exit day, that's the limit in 12.1. The limit in 12.2 is even tighter, because we're not able to do those things unless the minister or their minister believes it is urgent or necessary in the public interest. Now, these are very tight restrictions. And then 12.3, Mr. Speaker. I don't know whether Mr. Speaker has looked at 12.3 because I think it informs what he's saying. Let me read out 12.3, Mr. Speaker. No regulations may be made under this section after exit day. There could be no total control on the government. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, what the Liberal government should be saying to me is give yourself a little bit more power. Because if the withdrawal agreement is entered into, at midnight on the 29th of March, which is the way that European diplomacy has tended to work, you can't make the regulations. Even in respect of a situation as tight as the one that you think you might be in, where you might need power, because it's something that needs to be enforced by the UK, but exit day and conclusion of withdrawal agreement might both be the same. So, generations from now, when this debate is looked at, Mr. Speaker, generations from now, when this debate is looked at, and everything they have said until now is considered in the context of the limitation in 12.1, the limitation in 12.2, and the very tight limitation in 12.3, people will realize, if they vote against them, that they were not genuine enough in business, I invite them to give value for the 24 hours that they have, in my view, wasted, in their view, needed, and demonstrate that they now realize that this is not a power to circumvent this Parliament considering the potential withdrawal agreement and the parts that they don't like, because it is so tightly drafted, they should be taking it out of somebody's salary, how tightly drafted it is, Mr. Speaker, and the local power is good. Rightly so, if I may say so.
Mr. Chairman, everybody here on this side of the House, taking the position just simply because we want to be difficult or we want to embarrass the government. We're taking a position that is held in good faith because of concerns, genuine concerns in relation to this. And we have attempted, I repeat what I said in the course of my own intervention, that during the course of the Select Committee, I invited the government to consider hiding off some of this so that we could avoid having this particular argument. I think the difficulty, and I understand, perhaps I have some sympathy for some of the points that the Honourable Chief Minister has made, but the problem with this is, in my respective view, the definition of withdrawal agreement in the bill, and the way that the withdrawal agreement is defined in the bill. That's the difficulty. And that is what causes us difficulty with the position that, of course, that we have taken, with the political position that has been taken, with that the FDA obviously does not want that position to be compromised by us voting in favour of the bill. Despite the fact that we have said that we agree with 99.98% of it.
Well, I don't think Honourable Gemma has to explain himself in the way that he has. But let me just say this. The definition of withdrawal agreement is the only definition that can be. If the United Kingdom and the European Union enter into a withdrawal agreement, that is the withdrawal agreement that removes us from the European Union and has to be done effective. So, whether we like it or not, Mr. Speaker, that is our advice. The advice that we have is that whether or not we like it, it will have consequences of public international law. The United Kingdom remains responsible for Gibraltar's compliance with its international obligations. Therefore, we need to be able to implement the withdrawal agreement in Gibraltar, and we need this very limited power in order to be able to do so. But, Mr. Speaker, can I just take the last point that the Honourable Gentleman has made, which I think is an honest one, because I think that we can hide it off. Whether he's making the arguments in good faith or not, I think this is a problem with which he has found himself. It's not one of his making. It was helpful for me to him to say that very clearly. I don't think this is a problem of his making. I think it's a problem with which he has found himself. I don't think he can embarrass us, however much the opposition might try. And in terms of being too difficult, look, you are out here and there is not going to change the result. But let's be clear, Mr. Speaker. This is a bill that has to pass for all the reasons that we've debated. If they have the concern that they have, I invite them, Mr. Speaker, and now please let's put behind us all of the arguments that we have to have. I invite them, and I will do so now, Mr. Speaker, when I call a decision in respect of this section, I invite them to vote against this section, which is the one that they said they have a problem with, right? Because the definition of withdrawal agreement, which is the only way of pretending that one has a problem with the rest of the bill, is the definition that has to be, which is the agreement done between the United Kingdom and the European Union. That is the withdrawal agreement. Let them vote against this section, and then let them support the bill at their third reading. Because, Mr. Speaker, when history comes to judge, this is the moment. This is now the moment when we determine whether we leave the European Union together and whether we act together, Mr. Speaker, in taking our nation out of this union of which we want to continue members, or whether we act in a fractured manner, even on something where the argument is esoteric and illegal. And that, Mr. Speaker, is an invitation I make in good faith.
Mr. Speaker, well, I'm very grateful to the Honourable Mr. Speaker, and I think the leader of the opposition is now going to identify the section that we will be voting against, which will allow us to set out our position on the record, and then will allow us to vote in favour, as the leader of the opposition, correct me if I'm wrong, of the bill in general.
I think that is a very constructive approach, if I may say so. I think it's unfortunate that it's taken this time the debate for them to reach that position, but I think it is a much more constructive attitude than they've shown today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll close at 4:12. But there are 2 points. One is that, and I fully appreciate that there is a lot of similar, not identical language with the UK Withdrawal Act 2018, but the sort of the mirror image clause 12 in the UK Act has four clauses, and there's one that restricts the regulations that may be made under that section, and imposes five restrictions, A to E, which no doubt the government will be familiar with. Regulations under the section may not impose or increase taxes or fees, make retrospective provision, create a relevant criminal offence, establish a public authority, or amend, etc. Maybe the right to associate the money here as an employer. But it has some kind of restrictions as to what may be done by regulation. And I'm sort of interested to hear why we don't have similar type restrictions in this section for our domestic legislation. And the second point I would like some clarification on is, again, I recognise that a lot of language has been lifted from the United Kingdom European Union Withdrawal Act,
but including the definition. I know it's clear whether using the same definition of withdrawal rights as the UK is using is appropriate in our case, because they use the same language. And I think that the bit that is problematical, I suppose, is whether it's whether rectified or not, and whether in our case we should say and rectified. Again, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but it just seems more logical in our case that we're only interested in an agreement that actually exists. I'll be grateful to the government for the
Two points there. I'll take the first one on ratification first. I would say that it may have been entered into, but it may not yet have been ratified, because ratification may require a period of time, and formal ratification sometimes, as vulnerable members will now know, given what I had to tell them about the depository in the context of the Hague Convention, sometimes requires months to catch up with itself, and it's just a technical process. And therefore, we don't need to give effect to things which have an effect on people's lives on day one, although the ratification process is ongoing. The Maastricht Treaty was signed up by all the parties. Ratification didn't mean the moment of signature in international treaty language. That is one part of ratification. But if all the parties are agreed, ratification can then take its course, and that's why the language has to be that language. Second, Mr. Speaker, the reason why we agreed to take out the five tests, which are not, or the five criteria, which are not relevant to us. I mean, the Eurobotanic Investors, we have absolutely no intention of raising taxation, raising the public authority, creating criminal offences, other than that of being a very difficult member of the opposition, and et cetera, et cetera. But the Honourable Member has failed in his analysis to point out to the House, Mr. Speaker, that actually our regulation 12.2 is much tighter than the United Kingdom regulation. We have an additional very high threshold bar where the Deputy Chief Minister will be adding that in order to exercise the power, not just be open, but it be necessary in the public interest. Now, the public interest, Mr. Speaker, is the highest bar that a government must set for itself. The government must say, I need to do this in the public interest. We never do that lightly. That is an additional set of handcuffs that have been added by our draftsmen, which are not in the UK draft, which makes it even harder for us to use this power than it is for United Kingdom ministers, where, as long as they don't put themselves up on the five key elements that the Honourable Gentleman has pointed out, then the only box they need to tick is the box of urgency. We need to tick the box of urgency and the box of public interest.
Okay. Yes, the Honourable. I'm grateful for the Mr. Tony's intervention by Mr. Clinton. In fact, that's exactly the position that we attempted to reach last night and this morning with our own team. And it's unfortunate, Mr. Chairman, that the blood had to be split, that we've now met today, and I think we've come to a reasonable position. I'm grateful for the invitation extended by the government to this side of the House. And I can indicate from this side of the House, insofar as the sections that we find objectionable, that we will vote against 5, 7, 11, and 15, as well as, of course, the interpretation as it relates to Section 12, i.e., the part of Section 3 that relates to Section 12. The reason why, Mr. Chairman, that we will vote against in terms of 5, 7, 11, and 15 is because of the potential read across. With Section 12 and the implementation of the Gibraltar Protocol, the Whitfield Agreement, and MOUs which we have said that we do not endorse, Mr. Chairman. And that is the reason why we will adopt that accommodation, which will inevitably mean that, Mr. Chairman, that we will vote in favour of the bill at the third meeting.
I think the political spirit that we must all declare at these difficult moments for our community. I'm delighted to hear that we've been able to reach that accommodation. I'm thrilled to tell the Honourable Gentleman that clauses 5, 7, and 11 have already stood part of the bill, and nobody has voted against them. But I am prepared, in the context of trying to achieve something positive for the community, to ask you, Mr. Speaker, Leader of the House, whether you will agree to put those sections again for the vote so that Honourable Members can vote against them, or whether we could simply record their view that they would have recorded voted against them if a division had been called in respect of those clauses. But
also with the caveat that when I am teaching the course on Gibraltar's withdrawal from the European Union at Gibraltar's University, which will then be one of the most successful law courses available in Europe, I will be pointing this out when I take people through the answer.
Chairman, just in relation to, I know we haven't got there, so I'm taking this out of order, but in relation to 15, first the Deputy Minister of Chief Minister, just clarify one thing for me in relation to 15.1 and 15.4. Does the government feel slightly uncomfortable that this may loosen the handcuffs as the Chief Minister put in relation to the powers of, and the restraints on the power under Section 12, 2 and 3? Which has some consequence on transitional provisions, whether or not, I'm not sure, and that's why I'm asking for clarification, as to whether there's a loosening of the handcuffs there.
So, Mr. Speaker, because those are the transitional transitory saving provisions, but they still have to get over those hurdles. You're not able to do anything which might be in relation to the withdrawal agreement, because you know, remember that 12 is in relation to the withdrawal agreement. You're not able to exercise the 15-4 power in respect of a matter which arises in 12-1 or 12-2, or indeed after exit day at all in respect of the withdrawal agreement, in any way which is looser than that provided in 12-12. The read across is obvious, and the Honourable Gentleman means the government to say that we accept it, we definitely do. It's our thinking in drafting it.
As I understand it,
you agree with the Speaker that the clerk will record that in respective sections 5, 7, 11 and 15, so clauses 5, 7, 11 and 15, Honourable Members enter a negative vote on a division. And 12. The official division votes against 12. Amen.
This is a look at the voting against clause 12, and therefore clause the honourable members of the government present and the honourable Madam Honourable are voting in favour, therefore clause 12 stands out of the bill. Clause 13 stands out of the bill. Clause 13 stands out of the bill. Clause 15. Again, clause 15, sent by the bill with the government ministers and the honourable lady was in favour, the official opposition against. Clause 16, sent part of the bill. 31, sent part of the bill. 32, sent part of the bill. 33, stand part of the bill. 34, stand part of the bill. The one title, stand part of the bill.
Now, Mr. Chairman, just for the record, I know when you have read it or when the clerk has read it, we have closed the detail of graphical error, so that if there's any future reference, we have made the detail of graphical error.
2019, purely typographical.
The Honourable Chief Minister. I have the honour to report that the Parliament Amendment Bill 2019 and the European Union Withdrawal Bill 2018 have been considered in committee and agreed to without amendment, and I now move that they be read a third time by class.
And now for the question. Finally, that the European Union Withdrawal Bill 2019 and the Parliament Amendment Bill 2019 be read a third time and carried. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
We're now going to vote first for second reading. A bill for to amend the Medical and Health Act 1997 so as to expand the power to make regulations under Section 66. The Honourable the Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill for an act to amend the Medical and Health Act 1997 so as to expand the power to make regulations under Section 66 be read a third time.
I will now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Medical and Health Act 1997 so as to expand the power to make regulations under Section 66 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Medical and Health Amendment Act 2018.
I move that the House is now adjourned to Thursday, the 21st of February at 3 p.m.
Put the motion to adjournment. There is a matter which I think Minister Linda Turner may find some guidance useful. And that is that motions brought to Parliament don't always have to be contentious or party political. There is the mechanism of a neutral motion. It's used in the House of Commons as well, and it has been used here in this Parliament when consideration is given to the report of the principal auditor. I indicated as much in conversation some time ago to the Honourable Roy Clinton, who takes a very close interest in practicing this matter, and I indicated that was a possibility. What is the advantage? The advantage is that all Honourable members can speak to the bill, to the motion, express their view, and any vote does not have to be taken. Members can either vote. It doesn't mean anything because all that Parliament is doing is noting the content of the document involved, and they can express whatever view they want to express. I mentioned that given what the Chief Minister has said and the fact that we are discussing and for about 2 weeks, and that gives an opportunity for members to think about that possibility very further. So, I now put the question, which is that the House should adjourn to what day is it? Wednesday? Thursday, the 21st of February at 3 in the afternoon. The House will now adjourn to Thursday, the 21st of February at 3 in the afternoon.